This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
I'm on the edge of a soya bean crop in the heart of the American Midwest. As far as I can see in any direction, and that's a long way as it's very flat, are huge fields of soya and maize ready for harvest. This is farming on a huge scale, where they measure their fields in miles as much as acres. I'm here for the BBC's One Planet programme because this is just one location around the world where crops are already suffering from climate change.
Here at the university, we have an international facility in global change research mimicking the atmospheres that are predicted to exist in the year 2050.
Innovative field-scale trials here at the University of Illinois were among the first to start raising concerns about climate change and the future of food production.
I don't think that the world can sustain a China and an India that has the same dietary habits that we have in the United States, that we have in Europe, and climate change to go with them.
Feeding the world's growing population is enough of a challenge as it is, but climate change is adding a whole new layer of problems. And it's not just a future concern, it's here now. Stephen Long is Professor of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois in the United States.
The climate is changing because we're increasing the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So most people have heard of carbon dioxide, which is roughly responsible for about sort of half of the driving of this warming. But ozone, which is a form of oxygen, is created in the lower atmosphere through pollution effects, is also rising. It is also a greenhouse gas. So ozone is a contributor to warming as well. Ozone and carbon dioxide in the lower atmosphere also affect the growth of plants. So it isn't just climate change which is affecting the growth of plants. It's direct effects of carbon dioxide and direct effects of ozone.
That direct effect can be dramatic. And when your crop is as commercially valuable as soya in the Midwest, it could mean serious economic losses.
In terms of ozone, we already know that it's lowering yields by something of the order of 15 to 20% today. We project that by 2050, those losses may be in the order of 30 to 40%.
Here in Champaign County, Illinois, soya is big business. The Midwest of the United States produces about 40% of the world crop. And if Stephen Long's predictions are correct, ozone has the capacity to devastate future productivity. And yet, just as ozone itself is an invisible enemy to the crop, it seems that despite being surrounded by hundreds of miles of production, soya as a food product is invisible to most people. Here's a very fair representation of the answers to the question, do you eat soya?
Not consciously.
No, I don't know, not really.
It's soy product? No.
It's the crop, it's the main crop grown in this area. Do you see it? Are you aware of it?
No.
And do you eat it?
No.
Not much. I know they make tofu, yeah.
In fact, unless they take extreme measures, every one of those people eats soya every day in the form of manufactured food products and in cooking oil, even if they don't choose to eat tofu or soya milk. Randall Nelson is Professor of Plant Genetics at the University of Illinois.
Soybean is the second most valuable crop in the U.S. following corn. And I suppose nationally, it's a very major crop for export. So nationally, it's very important to the U.S. The major use of soy is, you extract the oil, and that's used in human consumption. So certainly most of the oils that we consume in the U.S. is soybean oil, and, worldwide as well. I mean, that's the major use of the soybean oil.
Although that's the primary use, Cheryl Sullivan and Marilyn Nash at the National Soya Bean Research Centre were keen to point out that the range of soya products and uses has never been wider.
Well, right here we have soy milk, and it's chocolate flavoured, Down here, there's another brand called Eighth Continent, and they have light soy milk and vanilla soy milk. So here you can see we have veggie bites. We have sausage links, chicken and burger ones as well. And all of those are made using processed soy product.
Then what's left after you extract the oil is largely used for animal feed. Poultry are major consumers. Swine are probably the second biggest consumers.
Soy ink, soy candles, soy underwear.
Soy underwear?
Soy underwear. Yes, it's out there.
And this, to me, is what's amazing, the size of these fields.
I'm on my way to meet one of the local farmers a few miles out of Champagne. And with me is farmer's daughter and one of the university researchers, Lisa Ainsworth.
If you look to your right now, what you'll see is a combine harvester in the field actually harvesting the bean crop.
That's sweet. The way you spotted that is there's just a huge, like a little dust storm, and that's just the dust thrown up by the machine, and you see the machine.
I think this is the farm that we're going to, actually. This is probably Andy Edwards' farm.
So just drawing into his farm now.
That's right.
My name's Andrew Edwards, and we're here in Philo Township in Champaign County, Illinois.
And this is your farm, your land all around us here?
Yes, it is. It's my family's farm. I'm a fifth-generation farmer.
Fifth generation?
Fifth, yeah.
And have you been growing soya all that time?
Yes. The family's been growing them since they really became a domestic crop, probably in the 30s, you know, one of my great-grandfathers or somebody. But I grow them every year, of course, and this is my 41st crop.
41 years?
41, yes.
Just going back a little bit to the growth of soya and how important is it now?
Oh, beans? Second most profitable crop.
So it's big. It's big.
It is, you know. And
could you ever see it changing? If conditions were not so good?
Not at this point. There's farmers around here that wouldn't know what to do. I mean, they this is what they do. So, no, there's no going back, I don't think.
In front of the screen here, what are you looking at now?
So this is a map of the United States, and it's mapping out the toxic ozone levels.
Back in her office, Lisa Ainsworth showed me a graphic display of ozone concentrations across the country.
11 o'clock at night, there are very low ozone concentrations, so between 0 and 50 parts per billion. And they remain low during the night and even during kind of the early morning hours.
Soya is so firmly embedded in the Midwest farming culture that certainly change is the last thing they want. But at the university, they're watching and monitoring the rise and rise of ozone concentrations with an ever deeper conviction that some kinds of change will be necessary if the industry is to survive.
Ozone can form in areas that are quite far from cities because the wind blows the primary pollutants into the rural areas. So here we are in kind of rural Michigan here where you're getting very, very,
very high,
levels of ozone. But here we are in Champaign County, and so you can see on this particular day that we get up somewhere between 50 and 100 parts per billion, and that's not unusual.
It's actually what is striking to me is how that's varying through the day. You start off, it's all green, low ozone, then the patches, the yellow patches start, which are 50 to 100 parts per billion, and then it goes orange-red as it gets higher.
That's right.
That is just completely changing hourly.
That's right. And in Indiana and Ohio, you can see very, very high ozone concentrations develop over the day.
So ozone as an aerial pollutant is variable and dynamic, but can be consistent enough in certain areas around the world to pose a threat to crop production, according to Randall Nelson.
Ozone is a very reactive compound. It's dangerous to human health. I mean, you breathe it in and it interacts with living tissue and it's destructive to that tissue. So because of its activity, when it goes into the plant, it's probably destroying some sorts of tissue. At this point, we are not exactly sure what the effect is on the plant. We just know that it does cause it to yield less.
Although the effect of rising ozone is a bad thing as far as plants are concerned, the story is complicated by the fact that carbon dioxide, the rather more famous greenhouse gas, has an overall fertilising effect on some plants, and soy is one of them. Stephen Long.
What is particularly confusing is that carbon dioxide, which is vital for the process of photosynthesis, actually increases production. So this is one aspect of global change which is actually increasing the yield of crops, or potentially increasing the yield of crops. Ozone, on the other hand, is toxic to plants as it is to us, and it's decreasing the yield of crops. So we've got those two sort of conflicting areas.
Getting a clear picture of those conflicting areas is vital to be able to adapt future production to the changing climate. The University of Illinois was one of the first research centres to run trials in commercial field conditions, but under the atmospheric conditions of the future. They call them the SOI, F-A-C-E, or SOI FACE experiments, which stands for Soybean Free Air Concentration Enrichment. Professor Donald Ort is head of the Photosynthesis Research Unit.
Here at the university, we have an international facility in global change research that's unique in the world. And what we are doing at this facility is mimicking the atmospheres that are predicted to exist in the year 2050 under fully open air, agriculturally relevant conditions. And so in a set of test plots that are 20 meters in diameter, we're raising the concentration of CO2, raising the concentration of ozone to levels that are predicted for 2050. We're also looking at the combination treatment CO2 by ozone, because presumably that's what the real atmosphere is going to look like.
Earlier this year, in May, I travelled to Champagne for One Planet from the BBC World Service as the soya crop was being sown. We've come to the edge of a field here, newly planted with soya, so nothing showing here at all at the moment, bare field. And in the middle, a huge amount of engineering going on. Is the experiment actually in place at the moment? What are the people doing here?
Right now we're just setting up the final controls so that we can fumigate with carbon dioxide and ozone. And so the crop was planted on Tuesday, and everything was put into place on Wednesday, and we're just doing the final controls to be able to fumigate.
Okay, talk me through it. Can we go along the little path here into the centre of the field and,
sure,
and see it close up?
Thanks.
Here, through this tube. So the tube running alongside us is the one carrying the carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got to about the middle of this plot, this field, and this is, I think, did you say there were 70-foot... How large is that?
It's 20 metres in diameter.
20-metre octagon, totally circled by a huge network of spaghetti of wires carrying carbon dioxide all the way around the outside, moving gradually up as the height of the crop moves up. And what's that in the middle?
So in the middle there's a weather station that's sensing the wind direction and wind speed. And there's also a CO2 sensor that will be in the middle of the ring. And so that is on a computer feedback to control which sides of the octagon are releasing CO2 or ozone, and how much to release. We release about a ton of gas a day over the ring to keep the carbon dioxide concentrations as high as we need them to be.
And this circle is in the middle of a commercially farmed crop. The soya is grown here under conditions that would happen on any commercial farm in the area.
That's right, yep. So a regular planter came through and planted this field on Tuesday, and then a combine harvester will go through the field in October and harvest the crop.
Last year, results from these trials were the first to sound alarm bells around the world about how rising carbon dioxide affects plants under field conditions. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is optimistic about plant growth as the climate changes, based on indoor trials. These outdoor Illinois experiments showed the increase in growth was about half that seen in enclosed conditions, and complicated by the detrimental effect of ozone. This year they hope to look at soya growth under raised conditions of ozone alone, CO2 alone, and a combination. The researchers are also looking at as many different varieties of soya under these conditions as they can fit on the plots, in the hope of identifying genetic differences. Randall Nelson manages the National Soya Bean Germplasm Collection.
Our research program is trying to look, find useful things in the germplasm collection and then move those into experimental lines that will be improved that other plant breeders might be interested in using.
For me, it's fascinating because we don't see soybean in Europe very often. So could I just have a look at, could you show me some of what you're actually dealing with? I mean, it's basically, for us, we'd say it's like dried peas, maybe slightly smaller.
Or slightly larger, yeah.
So this is one of many, many little sacks of...
Yeah, this is part of a yield test in which we are trying to identify specific genes that may increase yield. You can see the seeds.
So small, round, all this kind of pale yellow color, or again, does that depend?
The commercial varieties are all various shades of yellow. Now, if we went into the germplasm collection, we would see black and brown and green, lots and lots of different colors. We have about 20,000 different types of soybeans and soybean relatives.
And the whole collection is right here?
It's right, stored in this room right here. We keep it cold and dry. It's 10 degrees C.
So big fridge door.
And 25% relative humidity.
I'm looking at what look like bookcases, but loads and loads of shelves, and look again like box files, but all filled with different varieties.
Different varieties.
We've moved just through another door. And do you think somewhere here in your cold store is the variety that will help deal with ozone in the future?
I suspect, yes, that's very possible. Developing the protocols to identify that diversity is the challenge.
In her lab, Lisa Ainsworth and colleagues are looking at specific characteristics in different varieties in the hope of identifying genes that could be used to speed up the search for new varieties. One area of interest is in high levels of specific antioxidants, which protect plants from some of the highly reactive and damaging compounds formed by ozone.
Well, I can take you over here to Kelly Gillespie, who's a graduate student in the lab. And so she just took a leaf out of a tinfoil packet that was frozen in liquid nitrogen. And this is a leaf that she collected out of the soy face experiment, probably from one of the ozone rings. And so what she's looking at is the capacity of that plant to quench reactive oxygen species. So how much antioxidants are there?
And more antioxidant would make that plant better at coping with higher ozone.
That's what we think, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in here you've got a bucket dramatically smoking with liquid nitrogen, presumably.
That's right.
Did they all come off this year's growing season?
They all came off this year's growing season. So that's one of her questions is, how does antioxidant metabolism change throughout the season and as leaves age as well?
You have some targets in sight. You don't have any genes you are ready to say this or that
That's
is
right.
at the heart of ozone tolerance, but you sort of have a feel on what you're looking for.
That's true. We found some that seem to be involved, but we don't know for sure that they have a significant role, and so that's what a lot of this research is aimed towards.
Good morning, 543 at DWS, 55 degrees at the Radio Center, and we get a report each week from the Illinois Ag...
I went back to Champaign in early October. The weather seemed perfect to me. Blue skies, light winds, and warm sunshine. Peak harvest time. And farmer Andy Edwards, like everyone else, was following the seemingly endless and very detailed weather reports and checking his crop at frequent intervals.
Virtually all of the soybean plants have now shed their leaves at 97%. That compares to 85%.
All around us, people are harvesting. I'm just not able to harvest yet. My varieties still have a lot of greenness in the stems. Still a few green leaves on the beans. But these beans, actually, the beans themselves are ripe.
You're cracking open the pods here, and
yes.
And they do look dry. They're ready, are they?
Yes, they are. It's one of those years I've been waiting to harvest these beans for a week or so, and I thought I would be harvesting them this week, but it's probably going to need a rainstorm or a change in the weather and completely mature the stems and the leaves.
What about the whole issue now of ozone and carbon dioxide? Is it something you're aware of in the field?
Not really. No, that's not not one of the big issues that farmers think about too much.
So you at the moment wouldn't have any concern about what effects CO2 or ozone may or may not be having?
Not really professionally at this point. Now, as long as there's demand for the crops and you're producing food, you know, it's an issue that probably gets pushed back.
It seems amazing that a 20% real effect on crop yields now is not something of immediate concern in the field. Everything else can compensate for that hidden loss at the moment, and it varies from year to year, so it's harder to pin down.
Just over 4 months later, I visited the very same plot again, for One Planet from the BBC World Service, with Lisa Ainsworth again.
Well, the last time we were standing here, we were looking at soil, so there were no plants that we could see. The field had just been planted. And now we're looking at dried soybeans that are ready to be harvested.
And what kind of growing season has it been? Is it possible to say whether this was a high ozone year already?
It was certainly a higher ozone year than we had last year. You know, in terms of people trying to do an experiment looking at ozone, we had a good dose of ozone this year.
So you are expecting results that reflect increased ozone from this year?
Yes, we are.
What we know from the history of this experiment is that when we see season-long stimulation of photosynthetic activity by elevated CO2, that translates into increased yield. And we've seen very substantial enhancement of photosynthesis by elevated CO2, certainly in the common cultivar. And then one of the questions that we're asking with these different cultivars is there genetic variation in this response? And it certainly appears from past years that there is, and we anticipate that we'll see that again this year.
What kind of magnitude of effect can the CO2 have?
Well, on average, our experience has been that it's on the order of 15 to 20%. But in some cultivars, in some years, we'll see no stimulation, whereas in other cultivars, in some years, it has been as much as 40%.
That's a lot of variation in response. And you can already guess that as soon as some sort of genetic basis for ozone tolerance is identified, the next thing is to marry it with a genetic ability for that 40% response to CO2. But these interactions make life complicated, and if there's one thing that all of the scientists at the Soyface experiment are agreed on, it's that the positive effect of CO2 is generally overrated, and that it's a mistake to think it will compensate for a growing list of negative effects, which includes rising temperatures, falling rainfall, as well as ozone.
And so what we've discovered with our outdoor global change facility is that the enhancement of yield by CO2 fertilization is smaller in the real world than is seen in these enclosure studies. And it's smaller by about half. And our argument now is that, in fact, we should be parameterizing with these more realistic estimates that have come from the actual field experiments.
Those results were pretty alarming.
Well, yeah, and I think we should be alarmed.
This means that if we don't do anything, crop yields will start to drop because of global climate change. And this will be made worse by ozone, which has largely been neglected in our projections of future crop yields.
How serious could those problems be? Do you think climate change is a serious threat to global food security?
I do think it's a serious threat. You know, of course, there's been the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment recently on this, and that is assuming really well we can compensate for losses in yield in the tropics by the fact that areas in the temperate zone will become more amenable to the growth of crops such as soybean and corn. But it isn't really that simple, because, for example, if you think of the Corn Belt, which is Illinois now, you look 2080, if climate change goes ahead, that climate zone moves into Canada. So just the soil will not be able to support the sort of production we have today. I don't believe it'll be that simple.
At Illinois, they continue to make their trials more elaborate. Next year's plan is to add water stress to the equation to see how that interacts with raised concentrations of ozone and CO2. There's a marked contrast between the flurry of activity in the university fields and the relaxed calm on commercial farms, who, after all, have just had another good year in terms of yields and prices. It's only when those effects on yields start to show that concern will spread. Stephen Long and Don Ort.
I do think that there is a reliance of the overall community that we've been able to increase yields over time, and there is an assumption that we will be able to continue to do that. But in order to do that, we really need to take into account what the future portends in terms of the global climatic environment. And that means that we have to do different kinds of experiments that we're doing in the past.
It's going to take time to transfer that. The technology's there to do it, but it's going to take time. And if we're thinking about 20, 30 years ahead, we've got to start today because we've got to transfer that technology to the crops. It takes about 15 years then to produce a pre-commercial line that you'd be the precursor of what goes into a farmer's field. Now, a commercial company is not probably able to think 30 years ahead. So governments really need to intervene here and stimulate the pre-commercial work so that we then have the breeding lines that the commercial companies can then take on. And if we don't do this today, we would be caught out down the road.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.